All right, the Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order for the House. We do have a quorum, and Representative Albright moves the minutes from Thursday, March 16, 2017. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from Thursday, March 16, 2017, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted, and we will move on to our next order of business, which is House File 2621. Representative Franzen moves House File 2621 to be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. Representative Franzen, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, say I have a couple of amendments. Can we move those?
All right. Representative Franzen, would you like to move the A9 amendment first?
Yes.
Okay. I will. Representative Franzen moves the A9 amendment. Representative Franzen, to your amendment.
The A9 is just, there was what was the A9 again? The A9 makes the enhanced and tiered criminal penalties apply to both the person who performs fetal genital female genital mutilation and the parent guardian who knowingly allows the act to take place. So what happened when we adopted the amendment in criminal public safety? We raised the criminal penalties on the parents or guardian that may allow their child to be harmed, but we didn't do it for the doctor, so it left a discrepancy for the person who performs it, so they actually had a lower penalty than the parents. So with the help of Representative Hillstrom, we cleaned up that language and the counties, and we're good on that.
All right. Are there any questions to the A9 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, so I understand this is increasing some criminal penalties for providers. We just got the amendment, so I haven't had a chance to really read this or see it, how it fits into the bill. But
Representative Liebling, the A9 replaces the A7 amendment, which you did have because it was posted yesterday. There was just a clerical error on there that we corrected with the A9.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, well, thank you. But regardless of that, Mr. Chair, what my question about this is, if it's raising a penalty, and I know the bill does raise significant penalties, and it's been to the Public Safety Committee, if it's, again, if we're again raising more criminal penalties but for more people, maybe this bill ought to go back to public safety. I mean, this is not normally something that we do in the Health Committee. And it may be perfectly, in fact, I think one of the things about the bill that was a little off after it passed out was the difference in the penalty. So I'm not opposing the doing of it, just that we need to perhaps send it back to public safety if we're going to do this, because this is, I understood there was a fiscal note that was zero, but this may change the fiscal note as well, because I'm assuming that there may be more providers that would engage in this that would be prosecuted perhaps more than the parents. So I just would be uncomfortable doing something like this in the Health Committee. I mean, I can't remember another time, excuse me, when we've increased criminal penalties in the Health Committee.
Representative Liebling, the intent will be to move the bill to the General Register today. I know that the Public Safety Committee is aware of the amendment, and they'll review it, and if they decide that they need to have it back, we can move it from the floor to their committee if they decide that they want to take a look at it again. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good to know, and I guess I'd like to know, too, that the fiscal note will be updated in addition, because this is where the fiscal impact comes in.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Are there any other questions for the A9 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A9 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. The A9 amendment is adopted.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A8 is the second part of the requested amendment from DHS. It adds female genital mutilation to the list of items that can trigger a TRIPS investigation. And that came from the department, and they are good with that.
Representative Franzen moves the A8 amendment. Are there any questions to the A8 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Franzen, this seems like a good idea, but I just want to be clear about what you're doing here. So are you, I know the bill as it came to us kind of makes this heinous act a kind of a per se egregious harm, and or it puts it under the egregious harm provision. And is this amendment moving it out of that provision? And just explain a little bit more what it's doing.
Representative Franson?
I'm going to phone a friend.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services at DHS. The amendment does not, Representative, does not remove it from egregious harm. It simply adds this to the list of bases for a CHIPS petition. It does remain an egregious harm, though.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to removing a child from a home and open up a CHIP case, I was reading that it immediately created a path of termination of parental rights. Is that for that one child or all the kids in the family? Could you respond to
Ms.
that?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
I'm going to have somebody come down from Children's Safety and Permanency to answer the piece for that. My understanding is part of egregious harm in the CHIPS petition, it would create an investigation into the entire home. But I will have our child safety staff, who is more familiar with those statutes, answer that to confirm.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Autumn Baum. I work in the foster care unit of the Child and Safety Permanency Division of Human Services. I would just like to clarify that by categorizing FGM as a type of, as allowing a CHIPS under a CHIPS petition, that this does not, an individual assessment of each child in that family would have to be conducted in order to move forward with the other children in the family.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do that include removing all the children from the home with the possibility of termination of all of parental rights for all the children?
Would Ms. Baum. Open up the possibility for assessment of each child in that family to be conducted.
Representative Moran.
I would stop there until I hear more about the bill itself. Thank you.
Representative Crescia.
Mr. Chair, if the testifier could stay for 1 second.
Yeah, if you could come back down, please.
And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
My name is Autumn Baum.
Thank you. So I think I understand. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It doesn't automatically go to an out-of-home placement. Is that correct? It just triggers an investigation.
Ms. Baum.
That is correct.
So,
Senator Crescia.
Thank you. So just for clarification, so as any other situation, this triggers an investigation which could result in either unification or out-of-home placement depending on the culture and all the facts. Is that correct?
Ms. Baum. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Understood. Crescia. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for this testifier? See none. Thank you, Ms. Baum, for your testimony this morning. Are there any other questions to the 8-8 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the 8-8 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the 8-8 amendment is adopted. Representative Franson, we have the bill in the form you wish to present it to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2621 is a human rights issue, a women's health issue, and a gender violence issue. The issue before us is called female genital mutilation, and it is a very serious topic. In no way, and in fact, it may make you uncomfortable to listen to. However, it is in no way as uncomfortable or painful to what little girls are experiencing. In 2012, the United Nations adopted a resolution calling on the international community to ramp up efforts to end the practice. Female genital mutilation is classified into four types. Type 1, often referred to as clitoridectomy. This is a partial or total removal of the clitoris. Type 2 is often referred to as excision. This is the partial or total removal of the clitoris and the labia minora with or without excision of the labia majora. Type 3, often referred to as infibulation, this is the narrowing of the vaginal opening through the creation of a covering seal. The seal is formed by cutting and repositioning the labia minora or labia majora, sometimes through stitching, with or without the removal of the clitoris. Later, in order to allow intercourse or for childbirth, the woman needs to have this undone, which is called deinfibulation, and sometimes that process repeats itself. Type 4 includes all other harmful procedures to the female genitalia for non-medical purposes, pricking, piercing, incision, scraping, and cauterizing the genital area. In no way should type 4 be considered a compromise on female genital mutilation. It is still a human rights violation of the child. There are many consequences of female genital mutilation: death, severe pain, infection, bladder dysfunction and urinary tract infections, infertility, increased risk for childbirth complications, difficulty with minor gynecological procedures such as a pap smear, chronic infections, recurrent vaginal infections, sexual dysfunction, psychological disorders, which includes post-traumatic stress, anxiety, and depression. While the exact number of girls and women worldwide who have undergone female genital mutilation remains unknown, UNICEF believes it's at least 200 million girls and women in 30 countries that have been subjected to this barbaric practice. Here in the United States, female genital mutilation is on the rise. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimated that 513,000 women and girls in the United States are at risk or were victims of being harmed. According to the CDC, this is a threefold increase from its 1990 estimate. So why am I bringing this bill forward? For many months and into last year, I was asked to bring something similar to this. I did not think we needed it because I was just looking at Statute 609-2245, which makes it a crime to perform the savage procedure. But that all broke when news of 2 7-year-old girls were being taken out of state to Michigan, coerced by their mom saying they were going on a special girls trip. Never in my wildest dreams did I ever think that parents would find a person willing to break the law, hand their child over to somebody for the sole purpose of robbing them of their future sexual enjoyment, thus leaving the child to a life of health complications and psychological disorders. From CNN, the girls were told not to say anything and to keep it a secret. The doctor made them cry. There were 3 people in the office, 1 to clean up and 2 to hold the children's hands. Regarding the actual procedure, the girl told investigators she felt a little pinch. The area was cleaned. The next day, the girl said it hurted a lot. The girl described the pinched area as where we go pee. The girl told investigators the doctor gave them white stuff to put on, and then they got cake after because the doctor said they were doing good. The girl said she felt pain and burning in her genital area. The girl said 3 days passed before she felt better. No medicine was needed, and the doctor had told them no bikes and no splits for 3 days. As if this wasn't horrific enough, 2 little girls in our state being put through this violent act, which was allowed by the parents. But one of those girls, for a whopping 72 hours, was removed from the home. Medical exams proved that indeed this poor child had been harmed, and that poor child was allowed to return to her parents' home. The parents were required to provide this innocent victim with medical and psychiatric care and allow a social worker to visit their home. As far as the second victim, she entered foster care, and it is unknown if she returned back home. I watched and read the news like every other person, paying attention to this awful issue and thinking, how is this even okay? How are the parents not held responsible, and how is it that at least one of these kids was returned back home? And that's when I realized Minnesota law is silent on parents wanting this done on their child, and here we are today. And Mr. Chair, I have some testifiers.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of committee. My name is Bahil Khalif, and I'm here because I'm one of the over 200 million women around the world who went through female genital circumcision. As a little girl between the ages 7 to 8 or 9, I know my mother loves me because this is something that every girl has to go through in Somalia. Many Somali women, first generation, just like me, who's an immigrant to this country, all of them. I mean, if she was born and raised in Somalia, all of them has that. And as a little girl, I remember because I have 5 sisters older than me. 1 sister at a time has to go through.
And I watched them because I know next was my turn. So I run away that morning when I woke up because I know today was my turn. My brothers and cousins chased after me. They couldn't cut me because I, like I said before my stories, I climbed to the top of the tree and I said, you better not come and get me. My brothers and sit down there and waited till it got dark. My brother, younger brother, said to my cousins, leave her alone. Let's go back home and tell mom and others that we couldn't find her. The night got dark. I come down off the tree. I went back home, went to bed. In the morning, my mom and others come and got me off the bed while I was asleep because they knew I was going to run away. I'm not here today to say I want Somali mothers or parents who's doing this to be punished or send them in jail, but this is the future of our girls. They have a choice today. As a little girl back home, this is what we thought it was supposed to be because it's a bride. Every girl who's just good circumstance, you cannot go to school as 9 years old because you don't want your other friends who already got circumcised and know about you, you haven't done. I was cut that morning. I was tied each side of my hands, each side of my legs. You know, a lot of people say, why you tell this in front of the world? Because it's true. My clitoris, my vaginas was taken off, was shaved off, and my ulcers, there's no medication. And the pain was so real. I passed out. And the blood was all over the place. And when my blindfold was coming out of my face and I saw the blood all over the floor, my ulcers said, now you see, now you don't have it anymore. And then the stitches begin. You have to be stitched all the way down. And we have to be hold it down for 3 weeks, tied it up. So we have to pee on the side and hop like a rabbit because you cannot open your legs to walk. This is my story of millions of women out there and around the world. I have today sisters here, Anab Fatima, who is with Tosho Community. She went through. I have Frida. I have Wes, who also here. They all here to have their own story to tell because each girl, as they went through, but also is different. And I'm inviting all of them to say a few words because this is real. Today, what I'm here is to advocate, to give awareness to the parents. We have a new world order. We have a law and order in this country. If you circumcise your daughter, you will pay for the price because you know what? What happened to us in the past, we cannot do it. We can control what happens in the future. For you help today, how can we help young girls, not only in the United States, but all around the world? How can we help them? Because, you know, the action we took today is not only because they're going to be prosecuted, but how can we give the awareness this is not good to take the sexual and the pleasure away from the girls? I married my American soldier in another country. You know what? He did not know why I was not having sex with him because, you know what? He said, what is going on with you? After 6 months, I said, if you love me, you have to marry me because it's hers down there because I don't want you to touch me. He has to marry me because he loves me. When I got pregnant with my son, it's complicated. The doctor, American doctor, we were in another country in a base, in the American military, and he said to me, to have this child, we have to do some surgery down there. And I can go on and on and on. It's very painful, and I hope today is not my thoughts of somebody be punished, but it'll give awareness and advocate mothers who doesn't know and they think this is the way life is supposed to be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Khalid, for your testimony this morning and sharing your story with us. Representative Franzen, who do we have next?
Hello, everybody. My name is Wurs Muhammad. And as Fahir said, I was witness with my own sister when we was having. Actually, last week I didn't say it, but, you know, my sister, she was younger than me and she was scared, so they supposed to first loot her. So they closed the eyes. 4 people was holding 8 years old and they could not even catch it for her, how she was like suffering. This is not religion. This is cultural things. And I suffered when I had my third child. Still I have been going through my own son. And I have 5 children, 3 kids. I was going back 1 week after having the kids. to hospital, 1 week staying at the hospital when I come at home, which is infection. So we don't want to go through Somalian kids or even Africa, some Africa they have at Central Africa or North Africa, whatever, where come from this culture. We want to stop because it's not religion. Our religion, it's not allowed to do the girls like that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hamoud, for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else, Representative Ransom, that you have?
I do believe so, Mr. Chair. Fatima.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Fatima is coming up. Thank you, Warriors.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Fatima Abdinur. So I have a witness because I'm old enough. I know, like what she said for here, or worries, I agree, because I'm not worried myself or my older than me, but I'm worried the kids. I'm worried the adults, they are innocent. In the one world, they help each other. But my religion, oh no, not religion, but culture. The culture. But my country, my community, they are new immigrants. They need more advocate, more education, more advice. So, thank you so much. Bye.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Osman Omar. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very, really angry about this issue. It didn't start about the Somali community moving to the in the state of Minnesota. Years ago, 1986, one of my high school friends, she made a movie about the circumstance, this issue about the female. The only thing is the people right now, they are not talking about Somalia. They did not have at the same time when they doing circumcision for the woman. No anesthesia, no medication, nothing. They not have enough equipment to do that. They have a special metal, not even Caesar. And when I was growing up, my parents, they have a really argument about my sisters. That's when I was witnessing about this issue. It's very good opportunity for all the immigrants who move in the state of Minnesota and many other different states. In case these things, secrecy, a lot of family they do in many different states, as in religious stuff or different things. Culturally, these things and religion is kind of mixed in the community. I'm really happy this kind of, we can make a different law to stop it and make a better way to do the outreach in the community, including international. As in the United States, we have a laws, and those all immigrants who migrated in the United States, they follow the laws. The only thing missing here, outreach and changing the law, and they will follow the law. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And I want to support you this case because several different female when I was a kid, and they got an infection and they passed away because of this issue. And there's no law in Somalia, but every family and parent, they want to do the way they want to, and because of lack of education. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Omar, thank you for your testimony this morning. Representative Franson, do you have any other testifiers?
Nope, that's it, Mr. Chair.
All right, questions for Representative Franson. Representative Kresha.
And this is for the testifier, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So a couple of questions. First of all, I support the bill and where it's going. And my questions are the second and third terms effects of what would happen. How do we educate the communities? How do we do the outreach? How do we make sure that we can prevent this or at least get the information out?
Ms. Faliv.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I remember there's a sister in the community who already been doing this for the last couple of years, and our community is word of mouth. And if you want to talk to the community about what's going on, we do community meetings, and we travel around the state. It don't matter where it is. So what we can do, how to advocate, is what we're already doing. But this time, how can we do different and talk to the parents that things are not the same anymore? So what we can do is, sometimes people look for funding. If there's a money attached to this, it will help more to advocate and campaign. But if it doesn't have money on it, still we will go out there because this is real. We're going to talk to the community. We're going to give them awareness. All of these women you see here and many more who's not here today, and some of them said, why this has to be 8 a.m. this morning? Because you know what? They wanted to be here. And this is real. We're going to advocate. We're going to make sure we go out there. We're going to talk to the parents and say, this is the new law, and this is state. Make sure you don't do this because you will lose your daughter. Make sure you don't touch this girl. Don't abuse her. Sexual assault is real because that's what I do for a living. I advocate in the community. Domestic abuse, sex trafficking, sexual assault, this is no different. It happened to me. I can talk about it. This is my body. So I would like to, for us as a community, to put our issues on the side, advocate, and to save the future of these girls. It can happen.
Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. That is exactly what I needed to hear, because the real concern I have of this, if we don't have that, and please let us know how we can help, because my fear is that what we do down here is we'll make this law, it will pass, and it'll get signed, and then the system has to take over. And the problem is, in every one of these cases, is doesn't matter if it's this or any other child maltreatment, once this occurs, the child gets into the system. I'll give you a real-life scenario. Is I could see where this would happen. There would be an accusal, and the cops show up, and we put the kids in the back of the car. And suddenly, the way our system is designed, it's the only one we have where the victims are treated like the criminals. And then these kids can be removed, and then where do they go? So what we're going to need to make this successful is the outreach. We're going to need the foster care support to put these kids in culturally similar homes and so forth, because if the system takes over, there's a whole other set of rules that kick in that are just not good. And so, I need to hear that, and we need to know, because all we can do is pass the law and help, but we've got to get this to the family so the system doesn't kick in, because that's where the real damage can occur.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Baliev.
And Representative, and the good things that I can share with you guys is today a lot of girls are not being practiced the way it was used to be with me and these ladies in Somalia. And today I heard Imams, who is in the Star Tribune, he said, my own daughters, I'm not doing to them. And I don't want other daughters to go through the same thing. We will take this campaign not only in Minnesota, but all the way down to Somalia. So Somalia right now is part of, Representative, for instance, said earlier, the United Nations is not only Somalia, but every country that who's practicing FGM. I will do all my best with the help of this strong woman over here and many more women who's not here today. As a woman who's been advocating the last couple of years, her name is Fatou Wally. She's not here today. This has to be done. The good things is the girls are not being circumcised, but this is still something left. So those ones that is left right now, we have to go out there and give the awareness.
Representative Frisha.
Thank you. And so my last comment. By the way, amazing testimony. How is this changing? Is this also changing the males? Are the males' thoughts changing? I mean, I've heard one testifier, but we have to start there as well.
Ms. Faliv.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, yes, and right now I talked to a couple community members who works for the city, Twin Cities, and they called me and they heard about the news was happening. One man told me, this is something that we have to stop. He said, my own daughters are not circumcised and they will not be. He said he grew up in Kenya. His wife, just like me, she went through the FGM. But he said, today, we should not even talk about this. It should have been over a long time ago. So a lot of men today was like Mr. Usman. It's in the community. They will come forward and they will say, this was the past. How can we do better in the future? So for me,
I can speak because, you know what, there's still some in the community who still practice this. If you go back to Somalia, if you go back to Africa, if you do this ritual at the summertime when the kids are taking a break, when you come back, we're going to tell you, we're going to start the campaign right away. We're talking about, me and these ladies are talking about, let's do community meeting next Thursday in the heart of the Somali community in Minneapolis. And guess what we're going to do? We're going to invite everybody, imams, elders, leaders, everybody. We're going to ask them to come to the room. We're going to invite the lawyers. We're going to invite the medical, whoever can show up this meeting. This is just one of many that's on the way. And I know there's other people that's already been advocating. The work has been done. We cannot help the past, but what we can do is work on the future.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Cresha?
Well said. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Zali, what I heard from you and all the other testifiers, what I heard definitely from you is that this is a cultural piece that happens. And but you also said, you know, your mother loved you.
She did.
So was there any other cases of, besides this cultural piece that happens to all the girls back in Somalia, was there any other abuse or neglect that happened with you or any of the other girls and women?
Ms. Philippe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, my mother loved me, and she thought this is the way the life's supposed to be. It's the pleasure of the man, okay? Mm-hmm. This is the virgin that made by man, not by God. I'm good circumstance, and many other women in the country. No, there's no abuse because we are raised in Somali's strong family. My father loves me, my mother loves me, but we have to go through. This is the part of you have to be circumstanced because you know what? When your husband takes you in, he must be pleased that you've been circumstanced. They don't know better. So there's no abuse in the house. This is the culture we grew up. My mother had 13 kids. 13 kids, all her girls, has to go through that because that's all she knows. And today I want to say I love you, Mom. You didn't know better. So other girls should not go through this because it was pain. My mom loves me and all mothers love their children. It's not because we have to make sure that, yeah, thank you.
Representative Moran.
I want to see if the other, Mr. Speaker, had.
All right, Mr. Lamar, if you could.
Yes, I want to add it one more time. The reason I get back to here because of changing the law and making history today. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really asking this thing's issue is touched everybody. Back in the culture of Somalia, women don't have a voice. Some of the men, they call the shots. Some of the family, like my man, and daddy, the way they argued it was, my daughter, they are not going to go through this system. And that's why my father, he was arguing. And my mother and my aunties, all of them, they become the same side, including me. As a young child boy, I witnessed many issues in the community. That's the reason I'm get back to the table. Something we cannot describe as here today says. This emotion is not like a male or female. It's the gruesome things we're doing to the children. And who doesn't have any knowledge? We are in a modern world. Millions, millions of females happen to this issue. And the way we can stop is, United States leads the world. And also, United Nations, they did many educational system to stop female damaging. And the reason I'm getting back to here, we need to be really look focused the future of our children, not what happened in the past. And that awareness, education is a part of an outreach to community. Many issues in this state, in the Somali community, don't get better with the outreach to let them explain the how the thing is done, and that's very important. A couple of weeks ago, about 4 or 5 weeks ago, the some special disease for the Somali children happened to, because they don't get outreach. They go out of the country, they come back, and they have a problem because without immunization or any other things. This is more than immunization or like it's not a disease. It's just a cultural change and setting record for the law. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I feel your pain, and this is, like, truly wrong. Like, something to happen, you know, and I clearly hear it's a cultural norm, and I'm really happy to also hear that here in America that Somali women are finding their voices as mothers and are not doing it so much now. That's a good thing. And it is currently in Minnesota against the law, you know, and I truly believe you when you say mothers love their kids and they want the best for them, but this is a cultural practice that they brought from Somalia to here. And I say that because I believe I am a strong advocate for women and girls. I believe in family. But I have the same concern as Representative Fischel when we talk about the system. Because currently we have, especially within the black community, we have disproportionate numbers of children who are pulled out of their homes, put in the system, to age out of that system, to be disconnected from everything they know and love. That is what's happening today. And this bill lifts this up. And I'm not here to say it should or should not, but I'm telling you about our system and how difficult it is to get out of that system. Even with mothers who love their kids, it was doing something that is culturally what was done to them. So my hope, Representative Franson, is that as we go forward, and I hear that Ms. Ali, your commitment to educate, but I think this needs to be a commitment from the state, and that we should not go forward with this punitive solution. Because we have increased the penalty, it's a law, you know, and it is horrific. But I also heard over and over again the importance of awareness and education in the community. And that has to be a priority. And it has to be a commitment from the state to do that, and not just community members who are mothers and fathers going across the state on their own doing this. So, again, I hope that as this move or whatever happened here, that the education and awareness piece is a major factor as this bill moves through this body.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you to you for testifying, and thank you to the other testifiers. I think it takes an enormous amount of courage to talk about this in public, and I really appreciate that. And I have to say, the thing that is kind of going through my head when you're describing, when all the testifiers are describing these terrible experiences, is that I'm so happy that the United States can be a refuge for people. I'm so happy that at least when you came and when others who are here came, that our doors were open to be a shelter for people. And it pains me greatly that we may be turning away people who have that kind of need now. So let's just put that out there first of all. I really wanted to maybe ask Representative Kresha, along the same lines as the discussions moved here, there are a lot of things in this bill. First of all, this is a terrible. It is a horrific practice. It should never happen in this country, certainly. It should never happen to any other girl or woman. I think we're all agreed on that. There's just no question about it. This is just a terrible thing for someone to have to undergo and to live with the results. So, you know, as a health committee, I think there's no dispute on that. But just the piece of the bill that I am a little concerned about, or at least wondering about, is the part about that if this parent engages in this, that this is now put under the section of law where reunification of a child with a parent is not required. So it puts, I think this is what Representative Krisha maybe was referring to, and I'm not an expert on this, and he kind of is in our legislature, and so I just wanted to hear from Representative Krisha maybe a little bit about, and let me just also say, I think what Representative Moran is getting at maybe a little bit, and what the testifier was saying, is that this happens in families not because parents are trying to hurt their child. This is a little different than the other kinds of child abuse we usually hear about, where someone's doing something in anger or, you know, really, you know, blaming their child or something. This is something people are doing for a reason that we do not agree with and do not condone, but it's not being done out of anger or wanting to hurt their child. So one has to ask the question, even if a parent has done this terrible thing to their daughter, does this mean that the daughter should be separated from the parents possibly forever? So I think that's what we're struggling with here, and I don't know the answer to that. I think we all want to protect our girls. We want to, of course, protect any other girls in that family. We want to make sure we're doing the best thing for our children, for these girls. We don't want to harm them more. And so I wonder if Representative Krisha would comment on that as our expert. How do we as a legislature do our best to make sure that the system works? And we can never be sure. You know, individual cases can always go off the rails. There's no guarantee, but I just want to be careful that we don't do more harm to some of these girls who are terribly victimized by this procedure.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. I appreciate the expert title, but it's probably not appropriate. We're going to get this wrong in some cases, as we do with other ones, and it's hard. I know that. I look at this, and Representative Moran, her and I have worked together. As much as this has the connotations of sexual with it, it's probably more akin to the same debate we're having on the spanking in the African-American culture, which is, you know, when we look at what happened in a high-profile case of Adrian Peterson, many people were fighting on the sides of that because what was culturally appropriate. Whereas we sit here with a lens saying we believe that was absolutely wrong and what happened to that child was wrong, those are hard decisions for us to make, and we can't. And frankly, we're not going to be able to. So, I mean, the best answer I can provide to you, Representative Liebling, and I have gone back and forth on this. I have been through the legislation. At the end of the day, the act in and of itself is terrible, is egregious. And it's something that in our laws and the way we look at the lens, this is something that we say is going to cause permanent damage, whether it's going to be physical and mental. We know all that. So all we can do is make a law. And the challenge for this, and this is where every piece of child protection gets in trouble, no matter what we do, that kid loves his mom. Or, I mean, she loves her mom. And whether you know, the child has gone through severe beatings or severe other types of abuse, I mean, as a testimony here, that bond will never be broken. And that's the hardest part of this. But we have to draw a line in the sand, and we have to say, you know, we don't accept this. And I know that in some families, I have concerns about this. There will be children that may run through this, and they will get separated. And that's going to be a problem, or they're not. And that happens with all the cases. So I guess let me come back around to your specific question and why I think this bill does it right. If we didn't do what's in this bill, if we just had it go through the screening process and it became a family assessment, there's no investigation. So what we're doing here is we're allowing for investigation to kick in immediately, which is the highest form of standard. Which is, you know, we're not saying, and I was, as I read through this, we're not saying they're actually guilty. What we're just automatically doing is saying, let's investigate, which is the standard we do with any other sexual abuse. If there's sexual abuse, we don't even allow for family assessment, which if people, you know, if you're familiar with the family assessment says, we come in, we assess the situation, we find out if there's, you know, if we can just back off and not make it criminal. What we're saying here is, nope, we're taking that off the table. and we're going in an investigation to find out how bad the situation really is. Because in our standard, in our law, the child safety is a paramount concern. So we have to give our system the ability to go down that route. As hard as it may be, we have to let the system work. And I believe if, and I went back and forth this, if we didn't allow that to happen, then we would allow leniency and we would allow, we would allow for a social worker who's too busy to screen them out and say, well, I'm not quite sure this one's as severe as these other ones. We're not giving that to the system. We're saying, no, screen it in and find out. Now, to that point, remember, investigation, we all, and I do too, when I hear investigation, what I hear is the family's going to break up. Not necessarily. Investigation just means we're going down the tougher standard of investigation route. And we have to have faith that our social workers and our criminals, our officers, our law enforcement officers, are going to do what they're trained to do, which is hopefully find the best solution for that. And if there's other cases of abuse, and if there's other things, yeah, that child needs to be removed. So, it's tough. Believe me, this is tough, and we will get it wrong. Well, I won't say we'll get it wrong. There will be cases where the wrong thing will happen because we're dealing with dynamics that are so complicated that what we put together on paper can't fix them. It's the best answer I can give.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you very much for that, Representative Kreisch. I appreciate that because that just shows you do have a much more deep understanding of how this all works than I do, and so I appreciate hearing about that. You know, in general, I usually think that when we increase criminal penalties, we're all kind of, there's a sort of shared illusion that people read the statute books and know what's legal and what's illegal. And so usually I'm kind of opposed to kind of continually upping penalties for things, which is what we tend to do around here. But I think from some of the testimony that we've heard and the idea that this is a lot of this is about awareness, that I think in this case it may actually not be a bad thing to be increasing these penalties. And I kind of started out, wondering if, because I know it is actually already illegal, it's already a felony for a practitioner to do this in Minnesota. It's just not explicit in our law that it's also illegal for a parent, although it is actually illegal for a parent. It just isn't explicit in the law. So what this is doing, it is, of course, increasing penalties quite a lot, or laying out a penalty scheme for parents as well as now for providers. But I actually think that to the degree that that will circulate in the community, that people will know, that is probably a good thing in this case. So I'm kind of violating my own rule on that, but I think that there may be a place where it, just because of the nature of the word of mouth that the testifier spoke about, that people will know, you really, really can't do this because, and of course, the minute somebody is prosecuted for it, word will really spread. And so that probably will have a good effect. So thank you very much again. I think it's, even though we've seen only two cases in Minnesota, two is too many, and to the degree that we can get the word out there that this is absolutely not acceptable in our country and that we can really be a refuge for people, too. I mean, there are a lot of people come to our, a lot of reasons. Different people come to America as refugees, right? And, I think that fleeing sexual violence or fleeing other kinds of, horrors sometimes are reasons that people come. And I hope that we can really remain a refuge for people and keep our doors open, because I think that enriches us. And I feel it makes me proud of us to be able to provide that kind of protection for people. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for the testifier, and it's about the terminology the bill uses. The bill uses the phrase female genital mutilation, but I noticed when you were speaking, you used the term circumcision. I understand on one hand we don't want to minimize the act of what happened or make it seem somehow like less of a bad thing. But on the other hand, we don't want to stigmatize the women who've gone through it, make it seem like they're somehow less of a person or something like that. I'm just wondering, do you have a preference? Is there a term you think the bill should use over the other?
Ms. Philippe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think if you use circumstance of FGM, is the way we put the word in relation is what is it depends on what country or who is answering the question. But if you use the FGM, it's fine. If you use the circumstance, it's fine, because at the end of the day, the word is the same. It depends on how you say this is how you say this is a table is the way you say it, and the way I say it is different. So if you guys use it in the word FGM, it's something that we are learning as well. When we say circumstance, it's something as we learn at the same time, because we have good name. That's the word in Somali. So it's nothing either or. So, yeah.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Representative Freiberg. This is that's the terminology the UN uses and the World Health Organization. So worldwide, female genital mutilation is all over. That's the word that they use.
Representative Freiberg. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the good that this bill will do is not just passing the bill, but this is an uncomfortable, difficult topic. But having it in a public forum is part of what needs to be done so that the word gets out and that people are aware. And so, you know, I don't always enjoy that there are cameras. But here, I think it's appropriate we communicate. The question that I have, and I'm not sure who can answer it, this is a cultural thing. I'm a parent, and we didn't have parenting classes, you know, in a formal sense to train on everything. We did have things we gained from parents and religious leaders, etc. Because this is a legal procedure, you can't just Google. So where do they find out as a parent? Where are they? Who is it that tells them it's time that this be done and here are the people to go to? Because the people that facilitate it in that culture should be included in punishment.
Yeah.
Because if they weren't there, this would not happen to so many. So I've looked through this a couple different times, and I would like to be reassured that the people that are facilitating it within the community, propagating this cultural atrocity on new generations, are included in the punishment. Because if they are, there'll be a lot of parents they won't have that knock on the door, the tap on the shoulder for that advice. So that's what I'm wondering, how this is being addressed.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, actually that's already in statute 609.2245, and then we also update that statute to be a little bit more direct in what is. So if you look at your A7 amendment.
Mr. Omar?
I want to add it here for the outreach only is not the item we can reach the community. What's law is law. Many immigrants, when they come to this country, they get screening, whether they come in a refugee camp or usually they seeking visa or to come here. A lot of minor law they treat in the visa paper, and they know what's legal, what's not legal. That's number one. The other thing is the community here, we have to be clarified in the radio or television and other ways to be outreach, and it's really good way. That's the
All right. It looks like we have someone else here who can help us with the question, Representative Fum. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. It's Ben Johnson. I'm here from House Research. And Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Quam in particular, your question seemed to be if someone else in the community who's not a parent, a guardian, or somebody who's actually performing this helps to facilitate the act taking place, would that person be criminally liable? The answer to your question is yes. It's not explicitly stated in the bill, but that person would be liable under what we call aiding and abetting theory. That's 609.05. And a person is responsible for the underlying crime if that person intentionally aids, advises, hires, counsels, or conspires with, or otherwise procures another to commit the crime. So a person who comes along, says, hey, this is how you do it, this is where you go, could be prosecuted under an aiding and abetting theory.
Any follow-up, Representative Quam?
Just that I hope all the elders and in the culture heard that. On the public record, they are culpable and can receive punishment.
Senator McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a concern just regarding the placement. Maybe Representative Precia can help, and I know we've talked about it. Is this language, maybe House Research, is this language in the bill, particularly Section 2, does that deal with mainly current law in protecting children from sexual abuse?
Ms. Sunderman.
Section 2. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. Section 2 this is about the duty to make reunification efforts, and so by adding this crime to egregious harm, what it does, if you go to page 2, line 7, so these reasonable efforts to prevent placement and reunify are always required except upon a determination by the court that, and if you go to line 10, that a parent has subjected the child to egregious harm.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Just a concern similar to that of what was mentioned earlier about removal of a child and a placement in a foster home. I've heard from Representative Moran and Representative Precia that the system, whatever the system means, I think we should need clarification. I think I know what you mean. The system meaning our state government and our laws is broken, and there's a big problem, even a bigger problem, once that child is taken away from the family. So I know that Representative Precia has worked on this for 7 years or 6 years that he's been here and continues to do, but if that's a really, that's a big issue, Representative Precia, then we have a bigger problem as well. That if that child is taken out and put in the system, which we need to clarify that, and that's even worse for the child, then we're broken. We're really broken. And I know you've worked on this and you've tried to improve the law. You've, matter of fact, made a difference significantly last session in clarifying and helping heal the system to change law that the child is put in protective services or put back into his parents. But the question I have for the testifier as well is that, do you believe that once this horrific procedure is done, that the child should be taken away permanently from the parents and treated like a sexual predator, like others, according to the law, the bill is written? Do you think that is what's best for the child?
Ms. Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I was chatting back there with one of the Somali members back there, but I think the ones already is done, that we have no control of it. But what we can do, what I'm here sitting here not to punish anybody, but this law is going to help us to stop that. And when we're going to go out there, when I was talking to a couple of the questions, is I'm going to go back to the community, and hopefully you will help me, not just to pass the bill,
but come with me and advocate in the community and make the awareness stronger. So the ones who's already circumstanced, I have no control of it. The ones who's about to do it and who is about to travel to back home or whatever they're about to do, those is the one we can say, this is the new law that just passed in this country. Because sometimes the parents doesn't know what we're doing right here. But we go out there, I cannot do it by myself, and I'm hoping you and you, you, all of you, to come with me and hold your neighborhood, your community. I don't care if you live in Wilmer or Register or St. Cloud or whatever it is. I think this is something that we all can help and advocate to let the parents know this is the law now. If you do this, this is going to happen to you. Do you want to lose your daughter or you want to lose to stop to this practice? So we have a choice to go out there and advocate for it. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This conversation about the punishment is certainly important, and I also want to thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Franz, and for you willing to speak out about this, because I can imagine this is very difficult. But what I would like to know is when Somalian women give birth to a child, do they often have go to the hospital? Or is there more of a midwife situation? Where would a woman be giving birth?
Ms. Philippe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. It's painful. There's so many things. Some women will even stop having children. The infection that goes through in there, it can cause a lot of things, including cancer. Mm-hmm. It can make you stop having children. Not only that, if you have a children, like Rose testified earlier, her fourth child, she was still going back to the doctor because she had the pain up there. But I'm hoping today, as the past, we're haunted by the past. Mm. All we can do right now is to give this advocates an awareness. I'm not here to testify because somebody's going to be put in the jail, but we have the option and the choice, including you, for us to go out there in the state of Minnesota to advocate and give this awareness to the parents. Because you know what? When you go back to your doctor only sees this infection in there. He's going to give you a prescription to take care of that. And sometime, he doesn't know, she doesn't know as a doctor what's going on down there. Because you know what? As a woman, we go through what we go through. And I know some of you don't know nothing about when you go have female genital mutilation down there. So I'm hoping that all women who either die or could have a baby or still have an infection, that this is going to be something that they can be proud. And I know so many Somali men or women here today in the state of Minnesota who give birth in this country are not practicing it. But it's a choice. That choice is for us only to do is to go out there and give them awareness and the woman.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, could I follow up?
Quickly, Representative Keel.
Thank you. I guess my point is that rather than waiting and educating parents when the child is just a little bit older, that we also need to address this when women are having the problem, that we encourage doctors to explain to both the husband and the wife why this is bad. So when you give birth to a little girl, you are also educating the family to understand that this is not acceptable, but also the problems that we cause a child when they become an adult, and well, just from the moment on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important that we make sure that we're educating families right away also. So.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, and thanks, Representative Keel. That's such a great idea and thought. But I just wanted to comment. I keep hearing people talking about Somalia and Somali women, and, of course, the women here, I think, are Somali women. But it was mentioned earlier, this is happening in 30 countries. So this is not just a Somali issue, and I just wanted to make sure that people kind of keep aware of that.
Ms. Philippe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is correct. Over 200 million more women have been affected around the country. Not only the United States or Somalia, but like you said, many other countries, including Middle East and North Africa, some areas in West Africa as well, and I'm sure some other countries that I don't have in front of me that do practice this, not only Somalia.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for that point, Representative Liebling. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for speaking so much, but since Representative McDonald brought up. I have to speak to the system. The system is not broken. The system is overwhelmed, overtaxed, and failing miserably because of the inputs that are coming in. What we do here is create a response. Mm-hmm. And everything, and I need to say this because it's very important, the way this is changed is in families and cultures and educations. We cannot go back and create a stigma about a culture. Mm-hmm. I was at a Somalian welcome 2 weeks ago. We had a great dinner with them. We learned to eat some of the wonderful food. If we were to walk out of there with disdain and stigma because of this, that's the wrong response. Mm-hmm. The response should be what we all know in our culture and our faith as human beings, to embrace the people and help them with the laws and make families stronger. That's what fixes this. Mm-hmm. The system is overburdened because we've missed that step and because we've let that fall by the wayside. It's helping our friends and our neighbors and our families and helping them stay out of the system, as Representative Moran has done so hard with her community. I mean, that is the response. And so, I want to be very clear about that. We can only do the response here, and we're going to overtax the system continually. It doesn't matter with this or with other things we do, but if we don't get back to our communities and make them better, as you're trying to do, it's only going to get worse.
Thank you for that, Representative Khrushchev. Final comment on this portion, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to just put out there that
for
many that view this, look at this issue, from what I've read and talked to people in the community, that it really is about oppression of women, violence against women, and in other countries, human rights issue. Mm-hmm. And so I'm concerned about the policy implications and the with respect to going after parents and removing children from the home. And rather than focusing, in support of increasing penalties on those who perform the procedure, making sure that law enforcement has sufficient resources to investigate and to go, to prosecute those who are aiding and abetting. But if we look at this from that it is an oppression of women, and that women that do not have a voice. And so, and how many cases is this where the mother is actually a victim herself? Mm-hmm. And so, the response to going into removing children is something that we, in this country, we have a long history of that with Native American children, because of cultural, for cultural reasons but this is something, it is a response is what you talked about, having resources to have a campaign to educate. Mm-hmm. And that requires money, to put on billboards, what we do with other activities that we want to deter. And also that if we go after the families, will they be less likely to report those who are performing these procedures, committing criminal acts? So I don't think it gets at the problem. I think it's going to make it worse, because families are going to be afraid that their children are going to be losing. And is there limits on it? How far does this go back? So if it says report within the last 3 years, so this act has happened, and is a family likely to report it, knowing their child's going to be removed? Mm-hmm. But if it happens, then we would want the family to report it, so that those that are committing, that are performing the procedure, can be prosecuted. So those are that is why I think Representative Omar said we need to slow this down some, but make sure that we're providing the resources to enforce the laws we do have, and this is an issue that needs funding to support the community, so that there can be education within the community. Thank you.
Response, Ms. Philippe.
My hope is just to do what I just said earlier, that we do this campaign. I don't have the money. I'm always out there advocating. I'm an activist, and I'm going to advocate more. If there's money attached to it, that willing to fund organizations or community members who's willing to go out there and do the work, that would be great. But for me, this is something that we've been doing it And this organization has been around and been doing this last several years. And I think you're right, and it needs a lot of tremendous awareness to go out there and hold this campaign. And for me, if there's some money is attached to it, and it can help more to go out there and let the parents know what is going on and what is happening. Because sometimes some of the parents that doesn't even speak English, they don't even know this meeting is taking place. So it's for you to go to your community. And if you have Representative Omar and other people saying that whatever it is, then I'm hoping that you, Representative Omar, who's sitting right there, and all of you can go back to the community and make sure that this is real, that there's no child that will have to go through what we do, went through in the past. And I think if there's some money attached to it, that will help organizations and community members to come forward and request some of the funding to build the awareness in the community. And my hope is only to go back to the community and give this advocate an awareness. Thank you.
All right. Real final point this time, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think we hear, I hear a common theme that awareness and education is really important. And so when we look at what that looks like, it's like dollars that will go to the Department of Health who will partner with community. Because when it comes from those who are impacted by the system spreading the message, it's a stronger message, mm-hmm. right? So it's looking at how do we give the dollars that we need to the Department of Health to do the work, to do this work statewide.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Valib, thank you for your testimony today and sharing your story and being the advocate that you are.
Thank you so much. I can see a lot
of passion in what you had here today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in House File 2621? If you could please make your way down and state your name for the record and briefly give us your testimony.
Good morning, members. My name is Kade Wallace. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. As you're aware, it's a state agency to advise and inform the legislature and the governor on issues pertaining to people of African heritage in the state. The council does not have a position on this bill. However, I have Ann Hill with me. She's the ombudsman for African American families in Minnesota, and obviously, as it pertains to HHS references, and sees a lot of cases of African descent in working with them. So I thought it was very important for this committee to hear from her on how this bill will be impacting individuals as they come into the system. We talked about overburdened system, and certainly when new immigrant families coming in and not really used to how to interact with that system. And sees a lot of families, and I thought it was really important that this committee hears from her in terms of how this will be impacting families coming in. So, and we'll speak to that.
All right, Ms. Hill, welcome to the committee. We are growing short on time, so.
Sure. My name is Ann Hill. I'm with the Office of Ombudspersons for Families. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As the Ombudsman for Families for the state of Minnesota, and you all will be getting our report, I see well-intentioned good new legislation that ends up having a disparate impact on a particular community. Those of you who are on the Governor's Task Force for Child Protection knows that we did some good, that was some good work done there, but as a result of that, counties and families are now calling us about the increased numbers of children who are coming into an overtaxed system. I'm most concerned about this legislation that there was no conversation with stakeholders who are either working in the child protection system, are funding child protection issues, to see if there was a more equitable way of resolving this issue. I, too, am concerned about holding parents responsible, but I'm also concerned about us putting forth legislation, unfunded legislation that would tax the put a tax on first counties and county social service agencies, and that we end up not getting the outcomes that we are that we want. This particular legislation, as I see it, would have a disparate impact on new communities, our immigrant communities, because it's very possible that parents could come into this country having already had FDM and right away being charged with felonies. Now, is that really what we want, or we really want a campaign around how this can, how this having been a custom from where someone comes from, how this is just not acceptable in these United States of America. That's what we really want want to do. I worked on this issue. I'm going to tell you, this is not new. I worked on this issue more than 10 years ago with the Cultural Wellness Center. I worked with a Dr. Michelle. I worked with a doctor, a sister, Atun Azair, and I worked with Brecky Hewitt, who is Ethiopian. At that point, they chose to call this female circumcision. And I'm going to tell you, we had a very effective campaign with Hennepin County, the public health system, and getting information and education out to communities about this particular procedure. That funding was lost, and here we are again. Here we are again. I can tell you that this is not a matter for the child protection system to deal with. I can tell you that. They're not equipped to deal with this. I can also tell you that law enforcement is not the ones to deal with this and make decisions about whether or not a parent may or may not be allowing female genital mutilation. This legislation has taken this to a whole nother level. I am willing to sit down, bring stakeholders with legislators who are concerned about this and with community members who are concerned about this and come up with a collective solution for, one, educating the community, educating stakeholders, educating law enforcement if need be, and others who are concerned about. I'm concerned about it. So I'm concerned about the children. I'm concerned about their parents. And what we don't want to do is bring new Americans into this, new immigrants into this community, and put another ACE on them, another adverse child experience, because that's just taxing. That's just more tax on each one of us and all of you. So I want to do my part. I'm going to offer my agency's part. This is the kind of work that we do, along with Department of Human Services, along with Department of Health, along with law enforcement, along with county stakeholders, and especially with our new Americans and the Muslim community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the latest testifier. Thank you for bringing your experience to the hearing. Sometimes legislation moves quickly, and especially at the end of session, things move quickly because our focus is so much on the end of the session. And so that you're here, that you found the hearing, that we're talking about the issue, but also bringing to bear your experience from the last decade.
Yes.
So that we don't make inadvertent mistakes because we don't know where we have been in Minnesota is really important. And I hope, Representative Franson, that it's useful to you as you pursue this issue, the experience that she's bringing to bear in this discussion. And I think it's important to note as we talk about this, at the same time as I am hearing testifiers talk about the need to rely on the Department of Health, rely on the system, to make sure that we're advocating for and protecting our young girls, at the same time as that is happening, we're also making or proposed making budget cuts to the Department of Health that would be the agency to carry this out. I think we have to be aware of that as well. Thank you.
Anything else for Ms. Hill? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in House File 2621? Seeing none, final comments for the bill author. Final comments from the bill author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The United States is the land of the free and the home of the brave, and young girls, when they are in the United States, can be assured that they are free from female genital mutilation. This bill gives protections to those girls. It gives them a voice, so if they... if there is wind that this is going to happen, they can go to school and tell a counselor or tell a mandated reporter that this is what's going to happen and be assured that the state and the people are going to get involved and make sure that no harm comes of this child. Today we've heard from Farheel, from Warries, Fartuma, Mr. Erstman. I want to thank you so very much for coming and sharing your voice. And they are on a mission, members, to save the lives of many girls, and I hope that we can support them in that mission. And I also want to thank nonpartisan staff, Ben Johnson, Ben Johnson, for being a great help during this, and Representative Hillstrom as well, and the Department of Human Services, and also to the county over there. And then I also want to thank DECA for coming as well. Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Franson renews her motion that House File 2621, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2621, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Franzen. Next up on the agenda today, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Department of Health about the measles outbreak in Minnesota. If Ms. Ehrsman could make her way down for that presentation. Ms. Ehrsman, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record, and I apologize for the shorter amount of time we had today. That last bill took a little bit longer than what I was anticipating originally.
Thank you, Chairman Schumacher. My name is Chris Ehrsman. I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I have been asked to give an overview of what we're experiencing right now in terms of a measles outbreak. So let me start by saying that as of today, we are at 50 cases of measles. And this outbreak is mainly occurring in unvaccinated children. The outbreak started in April 11th of this year, and the first cases that came to detection were not actually the first cases in the outbreak. And so as we were investigating those cases, we discovered that there was a sibling who had had a much earlier onset. And as a result of that, we saw a lot of transmission of measles that had occurred before public health was even aware of the situation. We have not yet identified the initial source, so the child who had that earliest onset in March, we have not identified where that source came from, but we know that measles has been eliminated from the United States since the year 2000. And what that means is that all the cases that we see and have seen since that time have been imported from other countries in the world. So while we haven't identified a specific source for this outbreak, we know that it's come from outside of the United States. And our staff are looking at doing a look back and a search to work with healthcare providers to see if there may be any individuals who presented with symptoms that could have been measles that we can try and identify that initial source. So as I mentioned, we have 50 cases, and this represents the largest measles outbreak that we've seen since 1990. So this is a significant number of cases. The cases to date have occurred in Hennepin County, Ramsey County, and Crow Wing County. The majority of cases have occurred in Somali Minnesotans, so 45 of the 50 cases have occurred in Somali Minnesotans. But I want to be very clear that this has nothing to do with being Somali. It has everything to do with being unvaccinated. And so because that community has a large presence in Minneapolis, the majority of cases to date have been in Hennepin County. But we have seen spread to other communities, and so the Crow Wing County case represents that. To give you a sense of who's developing measles, the majority of cases have been in young children. We do have three adults who have developed measles, including one healthcare worker, but the majority of cases are in the preschool age. The range is from 10 months to 10 years. When we talk about this outbreak and the amount of work that it involves, I think it's important to keep in mind that the 50 cases represent just the tip of the iceberg. They don't represent the hundreds of cases that our staff have investigated and ruled out. It doesn't reflect the 7,000 exposures that have occurred. And with each of those exposures, public health and healthcare have followed up. So this is an extremely labor-intensive process. And the way that public health and healthcare work in a measles situation is that when an individual presents with measles, we interview them and we ask, we're looking for a couple of things. One is we're interested in knowing where they may have been exposed. And that helps us, tie things back into chains of transmission. Did this come from a childcare setting? Did it come from healthcare? But the other really important piece is asking them where they've been during their infectious period so we can identify who they may have exposed. And that's where we've found these 7,000 individuals. And then we follow up on those people who have been exposed. We identify who's not protected, who has not received the measles vaccine, and we follow up with all those people. This has involved excluding children from child care for 21 days. It's involved having health care systems do follow-up to identify patients who may have been exposed and getting those individuals back in within a 72-hour time frame so that they could potentially receive post-exposure prophylaxis is what we call it. It's either getting a measles vaccine or immune globulin within 72 hours, depending on the individual's personal age and circumstances, and in an attempt to help protect them against measles. Sometimes if you do that, you can actually prevent measles from occurring. So I just want to point out the very labor-intensive nature of this work. We currently have had 3 schools involved, 10 child cares, and then multiple health facilities. Measles is not a benign illness, and to reflect that, of these cases, we have had 12 hospitalizations, including one child.
Mr. Chair. Representative Dean.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chair, but are we going to, we have a floor at 10 o'clock. Is the intention to come back later, or are we going to wrap up with this discussion? I'm just kind of concerned that we're not going to have time for questions or if people want to ask questions.
Yeah, the intent was to wrap up by the time that the floor started. Again, I wasn't anticipating the first bill taking as long as it did, so I thought we would have a little bit more time with this, as it were.
Okay.
Ms. Yersman.
Okay. So at any rate, this is a very labor-intensive endeavor. And just to provide some background, how did we get here? In 2008, the Somali community identified concerns about the number of children who are participating in special ed in the Minneapolis school system, and there were some media reports about this. It really raised the issue of concerns about autism within the community, and really right from the beginning at that point, the anti-vaccine community has targeted the Somali community with misinformation. And when we look at immunization rates, what we see is prior to 2008, the Somali community, the children in the Somali community who were 2 years of age to 3 years of age, their immunization rates were at or above the rest of the state. And then following 2008, we see a precipitous decline in MMR coverage, dropping to 41% where we are today. And that low coverage rate is what has enabled this outbreak to really spread. Just to point out that there are a number of outreach activities that have occurred, and the department has learned over the years how to best work with the community. And I think that we have had some success, but I think that we need to expand our scope. But our approach has been twofold. One is to address the concerns about autism. When we initially started out, we really focused on immunization issues, but autism is a huge concern for the community, and not addressing it really was not to our advantage. And so we have a Somali staff person who focuses on normal child development, autism, what to look for, how to get families connected with resources, and that's happening at the same time that we're doing outreach about immunizations. And as the earlier testifiers mentioned, this community has an oral tradition, so it's very important to do one-on-one outreach with the community, which can be very labor-intensive. I do have some positive news to share, and that is that there are very encouraging signs within the community. The community is really taking leadership during this outbreak. They're pushing back and saying we don't want misinformation to our community. The healthcare leaders have really spoken out and provided their expertise to their own community members. And we've been monitoring the uptake of the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And typically we see about 30 doses a week. And in the last few weeks, that has increased to 500 doses a week. So we are seeing interest within the community in terms of vaccination. And then I'll just close by letting you know that one of the issues that has been of concern to us is the resource-intensive nature of this response. And we did, we have looked at, and we are asking staff to track their time. And just looking at the first 21 days of the outbreak, looking at staff resources only at the Department of Health, our costs were well over $200,000. That doesn't include Hennepin County, who would guess would have equal to greater costs than the state. It doesn't include Ramsey County or any of the other local health departments, nor does it include the cost to the healthcare system in terms of their response, not medical costs, but just the response and the energy that healthcare is putting into this. Then there is the true medical costs of the hospitalizations, the emergency room visits, and the clinical visits. And then finally, there's just the costs to the parents whose children have been excluded from child care who may or may not be able to work. So this is a very costly outbreak, and I wanted to acknowledge that as well. And I'll stop there, and I'm willing to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Ersman. We have about 7 minutes before we do need to go to the floor. Are there any questions for Ms. Ersman while we have her up here? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm really glad to hear about the uptick in vaccination rates. I have heard that sort of anecdotally from the pediatrician at HCMC that when provided medically accurate CDC-based information on vaccines, people do get their children vaccinated, and I've heard about the uptake there in the Somali community, so I was going to ask you about the numbers overall that you've heard of. So 500 cases sounds great. I'm also glad to see the handout here about...
Representative Freeberg, here's the graph of the happy increase.
Okay, that's great. I'm also glad to see the Commissioner Ellinger's request for a public health response contingency fund that was handed out here. I think that is a good idea and something we need to do. Particularly, I mean, this presentation is just about measles, but we've also seen cases of syphilis. We've also seen multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. So, you know, this problem is not going away. We need to address it. But, you know, for those diseases that are vaccine preventable, I think another thing we need to look at is the whole issue of vaccination rates and the exemption the lax exemption policy that we have in state law. You know, I have a bill that's been introduced, House File 96. I've introduced it a few years. I've not been able to get a hearing on it. I guess my question would be for you, Mr. Chair, more than anybody. Do you have any intention of hearing House File 96, either in the remainder of this year or next session as well?
Representative Freiberg, obviously it would take a Rules Committee vote to bring up this year, but hearing more of the testimony today and seeing what's going on, I am growing more and more inclined to be hearing it next year.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Mr. Chair. I mean, we did just hear a bill that I know went through a Rules Committee process to be heard, so I certainly think that's an issue that could go through that process as well, but with your inclination to hear it next year, I guess I'm... You know, that is encouraging for me, and given the short time, I'll keep my comments at that.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I had to step out for a minute, but about 10 days or so ago here at the Capitol, I attended a meeting regarding vaccinations, and the department was there, parents were there, and there were some other experts there. We had a nice, cordial discussion, although there were concerns. And again, we're lay people here, we're not experts, but I would be remiss if I didn't bring the concerns of the people about the vaccinations, and maybe you could address those somehow. It was shared with the department that day. But those concerned about vaccinations, whether real or perceived, you know, a lot of human action is based on perception. They were concerned about the number of vaccinations that were given at one time to a small child. That came up, okay? The other thing they were concerned about, and they provided some credible documentation by some experts, was the age at which multiple vaccinations are given to these children, and their belief that if the child was a little bit older, a lot of the concerns that they have would be alleviated. And again, there seemed to be a general consensus that, you know, vaccinations overall are good, but these were their areas of concern, and why you're dealing with, I think, a reaction in some immigrant communities against vaccination. The third thing that was brought up, again, whether real or perceived, okay, was that the ingredients in some of the vaccinations. And again, whether real or perceived, they brought up the ingredient mercury in some vaccinations, and also the ingredients of fetal tissue in some vaccinations. And there were parents there, again, immigrants, who had what they believed vaccination damage. Again, this was refuted by people from the department who didn't necessarily agree with it. And all I'm doing is reporting what came out of that meeting. I'm not an expert. I can't evaluate it. But if you address those three concerns, I think you'll go a long ways towards remedying the so-called fears, whether real or perceived, that are out there regarding vaccination. Again, I was vaccinated when I went to school. Maybe that's the way I am, or the reason. But so I believe in vaccinations, but that's what came out of the discussion.
Ms. Hiersman.
Thank you, Chairman Schumacher and Representative Grunhagen. So just a couple of really brief points. First of all, the number of vaccines that are given at a time, it seems like a lot for a child's immune system, but it's like a drop of water in the ocean. And if I thought you were going to ask this question, I would have brought some more data with me to be able to answer it a little bit more thoroughly. But we do have information to suggest what a child's immune system can respond to, and the vaccines that they are given is not sufficient to be a concern. So I realized as a parent myself that it's a little disconcerting when you bring your little baby in and they get all of those shots at once, but in terms of their body's ability to respond, it's not an issue. Then the question about the age that these vaccines are given. They're given at the age both that the child will have an adequate immune response, but also at the age when they're most vulnerable for diseases. We had an outbreak of an increase in cases of Haemophilus influenza back in 2008. And one of the children who developed Haemophilus influenza, which can be a very serious disease, their parents had the perspective, I'll wait until the child is five, and then I'll get them vaccinated. What they didn't realize is if you look at the epidemiology of Haemophilus influenza, it peaks up until the age of five, and then it drops off. So the reason that the vaccine is recommended at those earlier ages is because that's when the child is at greatest risk. So that's one of the factors with the age given. And then in terms of ingredients, mercury has been discussed at length over the years. It's also referred to as thimerosal. And childhood vaccines now, since the year 2002, do not include thimerosal as an ingredient. There may be, in some vaccines, and the FDA has a whole page on this, there may be trace amounts that are left over from manufacturing. So in other words, it's part of the process. It gets washed out, but you can't say, oh, it's 100% gone. But that has been addressed. And then the issue of fetal tissue. Fetal tissue is not in vaccines. There are a couple of vaccines that use cell cultures from the 1960s. So it's the same cell culture that was used in the 1960s to grow the virus, and that has been used. So there's some level of accuracy there, but it's not in vaccines. So I think I'm going to turn into a pumpkin, so I'll just stop with that.
And thank you, Ms. Eastman. And again, I apologize for the short time we had on that. That will conclude the discussion that we're able to have today on this. I thank the members for their indulgence. I thank MDH for not only their work on this, but being able to put this presentation together quickly for our request here and the materials that they were able to provide for us. Thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned.